What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Eric Levitz, founder of the Addiction Recovery Center AZ House Jerusalem, and a co-winner of the 2020 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for Jewish Unity and Rescue. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's the very first Too Jewish show of the secular year, which we all hope will be a much better year for us, for the whole household of Israel, and for the entire world. And one reason to believe this will be true is the development of vaccines that protect recipients from the novel coronavirus, also known as COVID-19. This past week, we learned that there are Jewish people who have been instrumental in the development of those very vaccines. While we Jews remain below 2% of the total population of the United States, we've had a huge impact on the creation of both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. To wit, Michael Dolsten, the chief scientific officer at Pfizer, is Jewish. He grew up in Halmstad, Sweden, son of a Jewish father with pre-war roots in Sweden and a Jewish mother who escaped Austria in the early days of World War II. He visited Israel several times as a youngster and did a year of his doctoral work at the Weizmann Institute. There he learned cutting-edge immunology, which led him to pharmaceutical science. Dolsten has referred in interviews to the rising anti-Semitism in Sweden. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla is a Sephardic Jew from Thessalonica, Greece, a city whose Jewish population was almost completely wiped out during World War II. Thessaloniki, also known as Salonika, is a very important Jewish center in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Bourla's family's history in Thessalonica goes back five centuries, and Bourla visits his remaining family members there yearly. He now lives in New York City. The chief medical officer for Moderna, Cambridge, Massachusetts-based company, is an Israeli immigrant named Tal Zaks. Previously, he served as head of global oncology at Sanofi Pharmaceuticals. Zaks got his MD and PhD degrees at Ben-Gurion University, conducting postdoctoral research at the NIH, the National Institute of Health, here in America. The scientist responsible with a colleague for the pioneering breakthroughs that allowed the development of an mRNA vaccine, first one ever created, the novel approach used by both Moderna and Pfizer for dealing with COVID-19, is University of Pennsylvania's Drew Weissman. A professor of medicine at Penn, he got his BA and MA at Brandeis and his MD in microbiology degree and PhD at Boston University. Weissman once had a fellowship at the NIH under Dr. Fauci. Also, President-elect Joe Biden has named his new head for the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief of infectious diseases at Mass General. She works as a physician at a Jewish camp for a week every summer. Finally, also in the Klan is Jeff Zients, who will be Biden's overseer for the whole federal coronavirus response. Zients led the successful effort to fix the government's health.gov website when it got damaged during the launch of the Affordable Care Act, the ACA Obamacare. Now, that's not to say that all the vaccine development and the U.S.'s new federal response team to coronavirus is Jewish, but that is to say, we Jews have had an inordinate level of responsibility for these successful results that we are all finally seeing become implemented now and over the next few months. These vaccines are the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's nice to know the Jews had a big hand in creating that light. To play us in this morning, here's a popular Israeli duo, Yonina, singing their original song, Halev, the Heart.
Halev patua, halev makshi, halev mevin hakor, pashut meir nachon, halev dover emet, halev tahor, vehu nifgash im hakor. Bet mimut vehu male be'or chomot chomot kemo mavok shel mechitzot ve'akolot חודרים דרכם ואיך כל הפיסות ומסכות הם אחד תמים וטעם והוא יודע איך להיות ולחבור בלי שיגידו לו דבר נכנסת בה
was the Israeli duo Yonina singing Halev, the heart is open. We're going to return in a moment here on to Jewish Our Guest, Eric Levitz, founder of the AZ House, a successful recovery program for addicts in Jerusalem, and a co-winner of the 2020 Kohan Memorial Foundation Awards, explains what prompted him to create this remarkable institution in Israel just a few years ago, and how it saves lives. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services both Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. During these days of coronavirus tsoras, a small group can join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning by emailing me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. And we continue to hold services with full music by Virtual Experience Weekly, as well as our in-person masked and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by emailing us to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or going to our website, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in blended formats as well, some live, some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, also taught on Zoom as well as in person, and of course all of our services on Facebook or in person, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's www.BEITSIMCHATucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Beit Simcha Tucson. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Eric Levitz is the founder of AZ House in Jerusalem, a remarkable recovery home for men in the Holy City, a place that was in desperate need of it. He's also a co-winner of the 2020 Kohan Memorial Foundation Awards. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish, Eric.
And thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the genesis of AZ House.
The AZ House, first off, is the only kosher Shomer Shabbat residential treatment center, also known as rehab, in the world that also happens to be free. So, and the way that it came about is, it's a kind of cliche story. I went on Birthright, and as soon as I got home, I packed my things, jumped on an airplane, and decided to move to Israel. And during that process, someone met me, and I told them about this idea and how the Jewish community was in desperate need of a free option. On top of that, I think it's better. And basically, he helped me start it, and that happened about 7 months into me getting off the plane.
That's an extraordinarily fast process. I don't know how else to say it. Recovery programs follow a couple of models. Yours follows a 12-step model. Tell us a little bit about why that choice was made and what you based the AZ House on.
I think that for the most part, when we're talking about like long-term treatment options, you're thinking of something that's predominantly clinical or predominantly spiritually based, like a 12-step based or something along those lines. So, I think it's important. It's an important part of the house for people to know that I myself went to a treatment center of an identical model back in 2012. For me, that was the only choice because it's what saved my life. But the side note is that, you know, my family, I don't know, they probably invested between $300,000 and $500,000 over a 10-year period trying to save me. And the thing that saved my life was a place that was run by people that had experience but weren't necessarily clinicians and didn't charge my family a dime.
It's a remarkable story. I want to mention that AZ House is now helping people, doesn't charge anything, but has strict rules that allow people to recover from addiction. We'll talk much more with Eric Levitz, the founder of AZ House in Jerusalem and the co-winner of the 2020 Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan Memorial Award, Foundation Award, in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcast. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And happy secular New Year.
Same to you.
There's been a great deal in the news about the normalization of relations between Israel and two of the Gulf states, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Morocco. What does it mean when a country normalizes relations?
Well, I'm very happy you asked that question, because first I want to vent a bit. A lot of otherwise responsible, reputable publications, such as Haaretz, The Forward, and others, have wrongly referred to these agreements as peace treaties. And some of them have, in a very partisan way, touted the major peace accords brokered by Trump. Well, I don't care who brokers them, you can't make a peace between two countries that are not at war. And that is the case of all these countries.
None of them had were technically at war with Israel, of course.
Right. And none of them ever has been. So let's talk about the difference between a peace treaty, a ceasefire, or an armistice, and what these agreements actually are, which is agreements to normalize relations, or at least move towards full normalization of diplomatic relations. All right, so each of those terms has a specific meaning. A ceasefire is pretty obvious.
You
two
stop
sides
shooting.
Agree, right, for 24 hours or 48 hours, or maybe forever, to stop shooting at each other. Those are frequently broken. Those are generally followed by an armistice, which is a longer-lasting framework that could eventually lead to a peace treaty. And then a peace treaty, which is verifiable, includes confidence-building measures, includes mutual obligations to behave in certain ways and to refrain from behaving in other ways. Okay. These accords are completely different. They are, in several cases, agreements between two countries that have had covert relations, either commercial or diplomatic or intelligence sharing or whatever,
or
for
all
quite
of the above,
some time.
Actually, yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
but they don't formally have diplomatic relations, which means that they don't have embassies in each other's capitals. It means that they don't have direct airline flights. For a long time, in the early years of Israel's statehood, there was no postal service available, so people living in Morocco couldn't send a letter to family members living in Israel. What they could do was send it to a cousin living in France and ask that cousin to forward it in a separate envelope to the relative living in Israel.
Right.
So that's a sign of not necessarily being at war, but having far less than normal full diplomatic relations. Now, what most of these agreements entail is largely the normalization of relations, which in fact is the formalization and acknowledgement of what already exists, and then taking a few small steps further. And we can talk about what those steps might be next week.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll see you then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And for the new secular year, two new parrot jokes among my own children's favorite style of Jewish joke. A guy walks into a parrot shop and asks, "How much is that parrot?" "It's $5,000, replies the store owner. "Why so much?" "Well, this parrot knows the whole Talmud by heart." Shopper is impressed. "How about that parrot?" he asks. $10,000. "Why so much?" "Oh, that bird not only knows the Talmud, but all of the commentaries on the Talmud." Finally, the shopper notices a platinum cage and asks, "How much for that one?" The owner says, $100,000. "Wow, what does that bird know?" man asks. The shop owner replies, "I have no idea, but the first two birds call him Rebbe." And a Hasidic rabbi with a parrot on his shoulder walks into a bar in Midtown Manhattan. The bartender asks, "Where'd you get that?" And the parrot answers, "In Brooklyn. They're everywhere." Those were the old Jewish jokes of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, second book of the Torah, with the wonderful portion of Shemot. I admit to being biased. This was my own bar mitzvah portion, but certainly, by any standard, Shemot is one of the greatest sections of Torah of all. It begins with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereishit, made up of Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, moved down to Egypt, where Joseph is the ruler of the country, really. They settle in Goshen in the north of Egypt and flourish. And then the fateful events that set the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph or his contributions, and the Israelites are now viewed differently. As they grow in numbers and wealth, the new pharaoh worries these alien immigrants could serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language, worship God differently. Their hair is curlier, their noses larger, their skin a bit darker, perhaps. They certainly have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, by the way, for the royal government. They set up overseers called taskmasters, establish work quotas, push them harder and harder, try to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews are tougher than the Egyptians expect, they decide simply to kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, later to be the priestly tribe, a woman hides her newborn baby boy until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him in a tiny ark, a new Noah, and sets him a sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is truly begun. Shmot tells of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to Sinai. It shows him maturing, marrying, fathering children in the desert, and then it takes him through the dramatic narrative, the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that will bring him back into the crucible of history and lead him to become the greatest liberator the world has ever known. Finally, it returns Moses to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There is almost too much in this portion to grasp, encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. Most importantly, unlike so many other traditions' hero stories, Exodus does not make Moses a god or even a perfect paragon. He is just a man, a great but flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to greatness through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. It is a great story, of course, but more than that, it is a powerful lesson. Moses becomes the model for every truly great leader thereafter because of his very humanness, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish everything. May we come to understand that we too can accomplish great things in spite of our own imperfections and limitations if we choose to fight for justice, for freedom, and for truth. When we return here on Too Jewish, our guest, Eric Levitz, explains what's unique about AZ House Jerusalem, how it creates an environment in which a startling number of young addicts find recovery and stay, and what the 2020 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award means to his organization. Learn all about it when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel has vaccinated about 8% of its population against COVID-19. The United States has vaccinated less than 1%, according to data reported by the two nations. Israel's health ministry said that the country has beaten its target of 150,000 daily inoculations each day this last week. Nearly 800,000 of its nearly 9 million citizens have received the first of two doses involved in the Pfizer vaccine. 1 million doses of the Moderna vaccine, which have not yet been used in Israel, have already arrived, far ahead of the March target date. Meanwhile, frustration mounts here in the U.S. As the CDC reported this week, just over 2 million Americans have gotten the first vaccine dose, far fewer than the 20 million targeted by President Trump's Operation Warp Speed for 2020. Over 11 million doses have been shipped across the country. In both countries, a lag in data reporting may be behind a skew in the numbers, but Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leading infectious disease specialist in the U.S., expressed concern. Even if you undercount, how much undercount could it be, Fauci said, so we are below where we want to be. Both countries are also experiencing surges in cases. Israel, which enacted a third nationwide lockdown, reported over 5,000 new cases Wednesday and Thursday, its highest totals since October. In the U.S., California has been particularly hard hit. The first cases of the new, more contagious COVID variant found in the United Kingdom have been discovered in the U.S. Some 35 years after his arrest, spying for Israel, Jonathan Pollard arrived in Israel with the intention of staying there. Pollard and his wife Esther arrived on a private plane provided by American billionaire Sheldon Adelson and were greeted at the airport by Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. The Pollards kissed the ground upon their arrival in Israel. A former civilian analyst for the Navy, Pollard was arrested in 1985 outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. when he tried to obtain asylum as counterintelligence agents were closing in on him for spying. The embassy turned Pollard and his wife, Anne, his then wife, away. Pollard pled guilty to passing classified information and was sentenced to life in prison, the only American ever given that sentence for spying for an ally. Pollard was paroled in 2015. In November of 2020, parole restrictions that restricted his movements were lifted. Netanyahu said two prayers with the Pollards, Shehecheyanu, the blessing traditionally recited on special occasions, and Matir Asurim, the blessing praising God as liberator of captives. Now you can begin your lives anew in freedom and happiness, Netanyahu said. Now you are home. We are ecstatic to be home at last after 35 years. We thank the people and the Prime Minister of Israel for bringing us home, said Pollard at the airport. No one could be prouder of this country or this leader than we are. This is a wonderful country. It has a tremendous future. It is the future of the Jewish people, and we're not going anywhere. The Latin American Rabbinical Seminary, based in Argentina, is opening a new branch in Uruguay, a country that has lured many South Americans during the pandemic with tax breaks and a low COVID-19 infection rate. Daniel Dolinsky, rabbi of Nuevo Congregación Israelita de Montevideo, or NCI, will be the director of the new institution in Montevideo, Uruguay's capital and largest city. The seminary, founded by Rabbi Marshall Meyer in 1962, is the only Jewish center in Latin America dedicated to both academic and spiritual Jewish education. It has ordained approximately 110 conservative rabbis since 1972. International media has covered how many Argentines, wary of its recently elected government that has Peronist, nationalist-tinged populist roots, have flocked to Uruguay, whose center-right president, Luis Lacalle Pou, in power since March, has led a more free and pro-market government. This movement is reasonable and follows the migratory and investment trend towards Uruguay, a country that we see with very good eyes for Jews to settle there and live in community, said the seminary's CEO, Ariel Stauffenbacher. The region is very volatile, politically and economically unstable, and the communities are affected. Therefore, a country like Uruguay is attractive for its tranquility and its tradition of stability, safer democracy, low rates of crime compared to its neighbors. I see Uruguay as a hub and refuge for the Jews of the region, with an enormous potential to provide services to the different communities there. Stauffenbacher said the seminary, which opened chapters in Santiago, Chile, and Sao Paulo, Brazil, within the last 5 years, also plans to open chapters in the U.S. and Spain, potentially in 2021. Our next steps are Mexico, Central America, Miami, and Madrid, Stauffenbacher said. And then, presumably, the Spanish-speaking world. A court in Pakistan last week ordered the immediate release of four men jailed there since 2002 for the murder of the Jewish-American journalist Daniel Pearl. The Sindh High Court in Karachi ordered the release of the men who had been acquitted of murder, calling their detainment illegal. They had been involved in Pearl's kidnapping, the court found, but not his murder. The court did not identify the murderers in the acquittal. Ahmed Omer Said Sheikh, Fahad Nassim, Salman Saqib, and Sheikh Adil were acquitted of murder in April, but kept in jail on executive orders as prosecutors in Pakistan appealed their acquittal. The two-judge panel of the court ordered their release from any sort of detention, declaring all orders of the government related to their detention null and void. The men are to be put on a no-fly list, must appear before the court whenever summoned, as the court considers the appeals against their acquittal. Daniel Pearl was a South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal when he was abducted and beheaded in Karachi in 2002 while researching a story about Islamist terrorists. He was 38 years old. And finally, Roger Berlin died last week. Berlin produced more than 100 Broadway plays and musicals and won 25 Tony Awards. He was 90 years old. A Jewish kid from Brooklyn, Berlin enjoyed a four-decade career in the theater that boosted the success of actors like Glenn Close and Jeremy Irons. He wasn't born into the theater, though. Despite youthful aspirations as a songwriter, Berlin found work on Wall Street, becoming a brokerage partner with Sandy Weill at a wildly successful brokerage. That all changed when his wife and three of his four children died in a horrible June 1975 plane crash in New York that changed the trajectory of his life. After that, building a business and making money didn't make sense to him. He eventually returned to Broadway, redefining himself in a new career. Brooke Berlin, his second wife, defined the switch in stage terms. His life was utterly bifurcated by the accident, she said. There was Act One and Act Two. I don't think many other people could have gone on to such success after such catastrophe. Berlin's debut production in 1976, Rex, a Richard Rodgers musical about Henry VIII, was panned by the Times theater critic and flopped. His last show, a Tony winner brought to the stage by multiple producers, was a 2019 revival of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. Other Berlin shows included the original 1980 production of Amadeus, which won a Tony for Best Play, and Sophisticated Ladies, a 1981 musical with a two-year run featuring music by Duke Ellington. Star-studded revivals including Death of a Salesman in 2012 with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Hello, Dolly! In 2017 with Bette Midler. Throughout his career, Berlin took the flops in stride with the successes, finding value even in losing productions. I know it's not worth it economically, he said, but I love theater. Berlin exhibited his own flair for the dramatic after the 9/11 attacks when he took then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani's encouragement of Broadway to heart and appeared on stage after the conclusion of what had been scheduled to be the last performance of Kiss Me, Kate. The show will go on, he declared to an emotional audience, extending a two-year run for 3 months despite declining sales. Roger Berlin rebounded from utter tragedy to build a great legacy in the theater world. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Eric Levitz, is the founder of AZ House, which is a successful addiction recovery house, the only one that's kosher and Shomer Shabbat and free, I might add, in Israel. It's located in Jerusalem. He has a co-winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for 2020 for service to the Jewish people. Eric, tell us who AZ House is named for. I'm located in Tucson, Arizona. Everybody thinks that makes anything with AZ Arizona, but that has nothing to do with it. So tell us a little bit about how it was named and how it came about.
Sure. The brief story is when I moved here from Cleveland, I got off the airplane and walked into a treatment center that was no longer open, which is how I became exposed to the Jewish side of the industry. And while I was there, I worked pretty much one-on-one with a father and a son, who were the last people, I think, that were treated with that in that program. And me and his father and his friend opened this treatment center together originally. We were the first three people that opened the place. And the third party we named the facility after his son, Avram Zev. Avram Zev Olive, Moshe Zalman is his father, who was the third founder.
He didn't survive? Is that the story?
So I never met him. He passed before I moved to Israel in 2013. So his father had, was very excited to have, his memory, help other people. And so we sat down in a meeting, and I liked the name, A through Z, Avram Zev.
Yeah, all of,
yeah. It was a very fitting name for a treatment center.
Sure.
And then, of course, when I put it into Google, Arizona kept popping.
I'm going to ask a difficult question. Treatment of addiction is one of the most difficult things to do successfully. As you mentioned, your family spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know of very, very expensive programs right here in Tucson that have international reputations. Their recidivism rate they don't publicize this, but it might be 90% of people that go back and start using again. Tell us how you manage that and how success, how your success has played out.
So I have this thing that I tell residents. I go, if you are successful, we will not claim that success. If you are not unsuccessful or if you fail, we also will not claim your failure. And the reason is, it's because 95% of the work falls on you. I tell them, we'll claim 5% of your success. We're giving you a bed. We're giving you instruction. We're giving you a great program. But ultimately, it's you doing the hard work. It's you implementing the self-discipline. It's you making yourself follow the rules. With that said, our success rate, you know, our success rate, the way that I looked at it, is of people who were in our house for a substantial amount of time, let's say more than 2 months, mm-hmm. about 60% of them are sober today. So our success rate is like 6 times the conventional treatment center. And I think a huge component is that we're free, and that the residents coming in, you know, don't have a dollar sign over their head. They allow the staff to tell them exactly what they are thinking. They do not have to, you know, soften up the truth in order to retain the tuition. They don't have to impress the parents. They don't have to impress anybody, which I think it allows us to do the most real work that we can. And it seems to be working.
It does. It does. I mean, indeed. I mean, as you note, the recovery rate of those who stick for a couple of months is really, I mean, I don't want to say it's spectacular, because, look, the tragedy of addiction is so difficult to overcome, but so many of these programs really don't succeed, except, I don't know, by chance almost. Is there a difference in the kind of addiction that you guys treat?
We deal with drug and alcohol addiction. We're not specializing in, let's say, dual diagnosis. We are not specializing in sex addiction, pornography addiction,
gambling,
addiction. Where it's not, like, to be upfront, like, we know. How do you say it? We're right sized. We know what we don't know.
Right.
And we don't have, like, me personally, I don't have gambling experience. I don't have sex addiction experience, pornography addiction experience. So it's not something that I can personally help someone with, along with the rest of the staff. So it's mainly drugs. It's drugs and alcohol.
Is it more difficult? Do you see any distinction at all between someone who's an alcoholic, someone who's a cocaine addict? Is there any difference between the things that you do treat?
I don't see so much of a difference between them. The solution is the same. I will say that there's a similarity amongst, let's say, these three different addicts that you proposed, which is they all think that they're different than each other. So it's tough. Like, you see the same type of behavior and thinking with all of them. And the reality is that they didn't even have a drug problem. They had a drug solution, a chemical solution to a spiritual malady, a chemical solution to all of their problems. They have no other solutions, and that they all have, you know, they have in common. There are more problems that come from the specific drugs that they used, but that's a secondary effect. The reality is that they're all pretty much medicating the same things.
So
their real problem is they have no solutions to their problems other than drugs and alcohol.
In counseling people, I used to say there's a hole inside. You're trying to fill it with alcohol or whatever drug is your drug of preference. You're trying to cover something. How do you help them fill that hole?
Our treatment center is based solely based on the 12 steps. They all get a sponsor. They all work through all 12 steps in the first 2 to 3 months, which is also something that's unique to our facility. Most other places hand you a big book and say, hey, go to a meeting. It might be a good idea.
Right.
And in our treatment center, before they are allowed to move on to the second phase of the program, which is going out, finding a job, starting to work, and then ultimately paying rent to the house to, you know, move on to the next phase. And they have to complete the steps before we send them out into the world. We want to arm them with a spiritual set of tools, so to speak. And, you know, our house definitely, we're not preaching any specific type of God. We're not pushing religion down their throat. We do cater to the Jewish community, as you know, with the kosher food and the Shomer Shabbos environment. But we're also not proselytizing them, or we don't have any religious motive. But generally, I would say 80% of them waltz in and, you know, identify this higher power as God. And a relationship with something bigger than yourself is what will help you fill this hole. It's funny, you say you have a God-sized hole, and you're trying to fill it with material things and drugs and alcohol.
That's a great expression. I haven't heard that before, but that's a big hole, isn't it?
Right, and you can't fill it with anything other than something that is equally infinite. like a higher power of sorts. I mean, for me, that's what it is. I believe in God. So another big thing that we do is a lot of these guys have never done the right thing over and over and over again for a consecutive period of time. Like maybe they do one nice thing and then they kind of live in self and then they do another nice thing. So one of the conversations early on that we have you tried doing the right thing over and over and over again for an extended period of time? How do you think you would feel? And what do you think your life would look like?
So it's developing a positive habit. You know, that's sort of what mitzvot are all about too, but developing positive habits in place of no habits or negative habits.
Right. So our idea is to change their entire perspective and to change the routine. And another one of those habits is we're very service-oriented. We want these guys doing a lot of service for each other, especially the kind that no one knows about, you know, folding someone's laundry without them knowing, you know, making sure to do your dishes and an extra dish if you see it there, picking up a piece of trash, just doing whatever you can to get outside of yourself. Because another thing with an addict, alcoholic, is a lot of their misery comes from this morbid self-reflection and a concentration on self, and that'll drive anyone crazy.
You note that a fair number, maybe 80% of the residents, do they come from religious backgrounds? They come from secular backgrounds? What's the distribution?
I would say maybe like 70% of the people that are coming to our house come from some sort of religious background. And it depends. Like over the years, it's been slightly higher, slightly lower. We've had people, you know, that speak Yiddish as a first language. We have people who are Reform. We have, you know, Haredi people from the Haredi communities. We do have it all. Of people who come to us who are practicing Judaism, it varies. I would say maybe 30%, 40% are still practicing.
Sure. How do people find out about the AZ House, and how do they find you?
We are this mythical creature, you know, the only free, kosher Jewish treatment center. I think not only in the country, but for what we for the 8 month long program that we have, I think it's the only free one in the world. I haven't seen anything else. And so there is this mythical creature, this free Jewish treatment center. So a lot of people know about us. We as well have, you know, the social media. We have Facebook. We have an Instagram. We have videos all over the internet. You know, in newspaper articles, interviews. We're part of a few different directories as well, and people. I mean, that would be pretty much, I think, how anyone. That's how people find us. And a lot of, you know, there's a lot of organizations, I think all the organizations know of us as well.
Eric, where can people go specifically to find out about you, and how can people contact you if they're in Israel, they have a relative or a close friend in Israel that needs your help?
Our website, my phone number is listed on the website.
So it's azhousejerusalem.com.
Yes. People could, you know, we're always answering the phone, and we're happy to help. You know, this is not a light matter. People are dying, and we understand that. So, you know, we're here to serve the Jewish community, the whole community, anyone who needs help, we're here.
I want to thank Eric Levitz for a great visit here on Two Jewish, doing this work of Pekuach Nefesh, of really saving lives. And I want to say again, Mazel Tov on being a co-recipient of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award. People can also go to your website and donate and help in your great work. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hope you go from strength to strength. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from a klezmer band called Kroke. It's called, appropriately, Yiddish Freilachs. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Rabbi Michael Swirsky, founder of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Study, a co-winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for Jewish Education and Unity for 2020. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a secular Shana Tova, a good, healthy, and safe new year, a quick vaccine, a good week, we pray, of health and peace. Thank you.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.